You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Chiemi Karasawa. She is the president of Isotope Films and also a director. She's worked in television, film, and commercial production for over 20 years with many notable directors. And today we're going to talk to her about some of that career. Chiemi, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're working on right now. What is the current project of yours or Isotope Films? I suppose there's a number of things going on, but can you give us a snapshot of kind of what's on your plate professionally now?
Sure. I mean, Isotope Film specializes in nonfiction content and parlaying that in many different ways. So whereas in the past I focused exclusively on documentary, by necessity, I'm parlaying true stories or nonfiction content into other mediums, such as developing television series based on on real stories. I have a documentary, a short doc about these two gentlemen that I met actually on YouTube called The Cousin Willies, who are lip-syncing drag queens from Compton who are currently living in Las Vegas. And I also am creating a narrative film based on a true news story that someone brought to me, and developing a screenplay, and hopefully we'll be directing it early next year. So a couple
of a narrative production, that's unusual for you, isn't it?
It's actually where the basis of all my work has been in narrative film. I spent 20 years as a script supervisor in feature film and television. I worked, for many years alongside directors like Spike Jones. I worked with Martin Scorsese, Stephen Frears. I did a bunch of commercials with David Fincher, M. Night Shyamalan. I mean, I've really had a fortunate career in that as a script supervisor, I was constantly working, and I started out in independent films. One of the first films I worked on was Kids with Larry Clark. One of the last films I worked on was the concert film Shine a Light about the Rolling Stones with Martin Scorsese. And then I started my own company to make documentaries. So for me, storytelling is all the same. Whether you are making a narrative film or a documentary, you're basically shooting, footage and structuring it to tell a story to an audience. And whether that story is fictitious with actors or, it's based on content that you're shooting of a real person, you're still structuring it in a way that is from your perspective and telling the story as you see it.
Right. So that's fascinating. I'd like to move back a little bit. I mean, you went through your history fast, and that was nice. That was what I know of you in some of the films, of course. As a script supervisor, that happened right out of school. You moved into that kind of work. That in itself sounds like a big break, and you're working with amazing people. I mean, the reason I'm asking this is, like so many visual artists and artists of different kinds, filmmakers are often struggling for their break or getting their work out there, and you seem to have been working right away with kind of wonderful and even legendary filmmakers.
Well, I don't know how immediate it was. I when I got out of school, I went to undergrad film school at Boston University. I moved to New York right away. I knew that I kind of wanted to be in the thick of it, and I started answering ads for interns. At that time, you had to collect the mayor's office list, techies list, they called it, and you'd go to the mayor's office, and they'd have a list of current productions in the city, and you'd fax your resume or drop by with a resume to whomever was shooting, if you wanted to intern or PA on a shoot. And thankfully, I got an internship for a producer that was producing an independent feature film called Hanging with the Homeboys for New Line Cinema. His name was Richard Brick. I should say the late Richard Brick, because he recently passed. But a director, Joe Vasquez, who has also passed, unfortunately, was making this film shooting in the South Bronx, you know, and I grew up in Southern California, went to college in Boston. So for me, hanging out, you know, on a night set for 6 weeks, shooting nights in the Bronx, Brooklyn, you know, East Harlem, was kind of exotic. And I learned a lot, and I got to hang out with John Leguizamo and Dougie Doug and Mario Joyner. And I became the assistant to the producer, because by that time I'd spent 3 months in pre-production with him as an intern, making my way as a bartender on the side at CBGB's. And I finally earned a position where he could afford to pay me, because the film was, you know, got greenlit and went into production. So I did everything from driving actors around to delivering sides to Xeroxing to, you know, getting coffee to driving the crew to catering, you know, wherever that happened to be from the set to locking up traffic. And then I realized that where I really wanted to be was I wanted to be that person sitting next to the director in a nice chair with a monitor, headphones, you know, monitoring, being right in the middle of it and really having that kind of vantage point. And I learned that that position was called the script supervisor. And basically, it looked like she took very astute notes of what was going on and got to be next to the director and, like, not coiling cable or anything messy. And once I really figured out what the job entailed, it was a little scary. But I took a workshop called the Kodak, the main film and television workshops. It was sponsored by Kodak at that time. And I took this immersion class in script supervising, and then I just started, you know, doing freebies on grad student films as a script supervisor to see if I could actually do it. And it's a really detailed, meticulous position where you're in charge of the continuity, in charge of creating the chronological breakdown of a script, timings. You're giving slate numbers to the camera assistant, and you know, you're reminding the actors of their blocking, everything to do with continuity and translating what happens on the set into blueprints for the editor to cut the film together based on the director's notes. It's complicated, but you really earn your stripes that way. People respect you. You're dealing with the, you know, director most of the time and the cinematographer. And it's a great vantage point to learning all about what happens in front of a camera and behind a camera.
Right, so it's a great way to learn exactly how a director functions. You're essentially working off all of these notes and manifesting
all of them. Just,
gives you,
you know, watching. I mean, you can't pay to learn, you know, how a director gets a specific performance out of an actor, or, you know, what they're talking about with the cameraman, with the DP while you're setting up. You know, how they're imagining things, the direction they're giving. I mean, it's just an invaluable exposure to all that just sacred information. And it really teaches you a lot about how each director is different, you know, how they focus on what they're directing is different. A lot of people are very, very technical. You know, Fincher is super, super technical. He wants the camera move to be just right. He wants the actor's blocking to be just so. The choreography has to fit in everything, like a little seamless dance, you know. And other people, like Spike Jonze, are more interested in the authenticity of a performance and the spontaneity. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a marvelous lesson in filmmaking. And I did it for a long time, probably longer than I should have. But it was too much fun, you know.
Right, it sounds like a wonderful experience. I don't know if you could do that too long, but are you saying it was too long because you could have gone into or started Isotope Films sooner, or what makes you think it was too long?
Well, I mean, you know, I did it for almost 20 years, and I feel like today all of the hot young directors are young. You know, young, meaning, I guess, 20s and 30s now that I'm in my 40s. I mean, they don't have the experience or exposure that I do, but I think that at a certain point you really have to make a leap, because the longer you do something, the harder it is to transition. And I don't know if it was particularly difficult, because initially I didn't start directing. I started a company to create independent films, and it just so happened that my first film was a documentary called Billy the Kid, and we got really lucky. We won, I think, the first four film festivals we entered: South by Southwest, Los Angeles Film Festival, Melbourne, Edinburgh, and we had a film that we had shot in 5 days. It took an awful long time to edit it together in the way that it ended up being, but it was both Jennifer Venditti, the director, and my first experience, you know, as a director and a producer of a documentary film, and it did really well. We sold it to HBO, and it's played all over the world. So that kind of launched a career in documentary for me because I was on the map, and, you know, suddenly people that I knew from the narrative film world, like Spike Jonze and Ellen Kuras, the cinematographer, were asking me if I could help them on their documentaries. Because everybody has a documentary in their back pocket, you know. So that was wonderful. And then Ellen's film, The Betrayal, Narracoon, which was an amazing epic about an immigrant's family immigrating from Laos to the United States and what happened to them over the course of 20 years. That film became Oscar-nominated, and we eventually won an Emmy for it. So that was a wonderful experience. To be trusted and enlisted by such veteran filmmakers and such well-respected people who are, you know, my friends from having spent so much time with them is a great honor.
So you talk about launching, you know, I mean, just a few minutes ago, Isotope Films and beginning that sounds very simple the way you say it, but it seems like something that now seems, you know, kind of visionary and wonderful, and is producing content that that comes out of a peculiar and particular point of view. How did that just get launched like that?
These are all very grandiose expressions, you know. Like I was renting an office space from my friend Jennifer at that time. We were actually introduced by a mutual friend. I didn't even know her. And she had a casting agency, and so I just rented a spare room, and a friend of mine and I were producing somebody's short film just to see if we could do something together, you know. And between our two contacts, he was a production manager, and I was a script supervisor that was transitioning into producing, which is kind of retarded. You know, nobody actually believes you have any skills as a producer if you've been a script supervisor your whole life. But I just knew that I wanted to get things done. So we produced this short film, and I thought, I could do this. You know, learning on the job is probably the hardest way to do it, but it's the way that I've learned almost everything. And I've had some fabulous mentors. I mean, by that time, I had, you know, 15-year relationships with people in the business. I could pick up the phone and say, you know, how do you do this? Like, who do I call for, you know, music clearances, or what film festival do you think is a good one for us to premiere at? You know, these kinds of naive questions that are extremely important. I had people to call and you know, mentor me through the ropes. And it was challenging. You know, the first year or two of my business, I was straddling a career as a script supervisor. I would take commercial gigs because they're short, 2-3-day shoots, and I would spend the rest of my time in the office, you know, trying to figure out how you're going to pay an editor to put this film together, you know.
A good question. I mean, I think a big part of that is also raising money, right? This is part of what you and at that time Jennifer had to do. I mean, how did you learn to do that? That seems to me one of the more daunting tasks. There's one thing pulling together a crew and having all the skills that you had and other people's had, but isn't the fundraising itself?
Quite
a large task.
I also think that it's much more difficult to raise money today than it was then. We cut together a trailer, which is generally how I do most of my, you know, putting together films. You have enough material to make some kind of a teaser where people and investors can imagine what it is that you're putting together. You know, it says something of the tone and the style and the content. Because people respond much more to that than they do a business plan, is what I've learned. You know, you can send people any kind of document you want, but if you can send them a little QuickTime and they can press play and watch a 3-minute teaser play out and go, ah, that looks cool, you know, that's kind of the way to do it. So we got a company involved at that time called IndiePix, and I don't think they're doing much of this anymore, but they gave us money to continue our edit because they saw potential in it. And Jennifer had some relationships with fashion people who were looking to invest small amounts of money in a film project. And we just kept, you know, applying for grants and fellowships and whatever we could. And we finally got a rough cut together and showed it to somebody that independently invested some money into the film. So we were very lucky with that first film, and I think it's always, you know, your first project is the hardest because it's so much sweat equity, you know, what they call sweat equity, and your own money. You know, I was dumping money into this film like, you know, a sand pit, you know, that I was making that was in my bank account and hoping that we were going to get some of it back. But when you line up the investment, the personal investment that you make and the financial investment you make, and you compare it to grad film school, it's somewhat equivalent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm getting on the job experience, you know, and I've got a credit as a producer on a feature length documentary that actually got distribution and went all over the world. And we went to, you know, Austin to South by, and we had the great honor and surprise of winning that film festival in 2007, which was just a shocking thing for the two of us, because we had never made a film before. And then we won the LA Film Festival, and then we went, you know, we just had a wonderful time. And then, I mean, there was a cash prize at LA, which is one of the reasons why I made sure we submitted to that festival, because they had a really beautiful target, $50,000 cash prize, and we won it. And we won money in Melbourne, in Edinburgh, and then when we got licensed, that was a nice chunk of change, and we could finally pay some bills, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, I mean, I have to say, I had a very fortunate introduction to the business. It was not easy. You know, the 2 years putting that film together is probably the hardest 2 years that I've had since. But it paid off in spades, and it also made me understand what the process of putting a documentary together was about. You know, I was calling members of KISS on their cell phones trying to find out if they would give us the rights to God Gave Rock and Roll to You. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any better. But I just knew that if Universal was going to charge us $40,000 a song, we were not putting any KISS songs in our movie, and we've got this kid playing air guitar to KISS music. And Jennifer said we had to have it. So I just, as a producer, you're just trying to support the vision, trying to do whatever you can do to keep the little flame, you know, going behind the artistic vision and feeding it. So it's
so that's
it's
a
really,
great story. Somehow yeah. You got some of the members of KISS on the phone, and what did they say?
Well, I think it was not Paul Stanley. Who's the other guy? The reality show guy. Oh my God, Gene Simmons. Gene Simmons hung
right,
up on me
right.
twice after demanding to know how I got his phone number. and then after Universal, who controls the rights, you know, in publishing and masters to many, 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 you know, music and bands and, you know, rock music in particular songs. I just started asking everybody I know, hey, do you know anybody that knows KISS? Do you know anybody that knows KISS? I mean, every time I was on a margarine commercial, I think, and at lunch, I was at the catering table, and I just asked the crew randomly, do any of you know anybody that knows KISS? and just out of the clear blue, this boom operator goes, oh, yeah, I know a guy that knows, I think he's a manager. I think he's a manager for KISS or no. Who he knew is this woman, May Pang, who is John Lennon's lost lover from, you know, the time that he strayed from Yoko Ono. And he goes, May knows KISS's manager. And so I called this woman, May Pang, out of the blue. I introduced myself. I told her my, you know, quest. And she connected me to a gentleman, Angus Vale, who I'll never forget. Like, completely empathized with the story. I was like, we've got this amazing film. I'll send you some clips. And he said, no, this is what you got to do. String all the clips. He was Australian. He said, string all those clips together, send me a note, and I'll forward it on to Paul and Paul Stanley. And that's how we got our rights to these four KISS songs.
Wow.
I'm telling you, if you speak to any documentary producer, I assure you they will have just as colorful a story as how they pulled something off, because you really become – you become desperate, but you become extremely creative with your asks, you know. I think I got, for Elaine Stritch, I think I got the Elton John song by posting on my Facebook page. Does anyone know Elton John? You'd be surprised what kind of resources there are out there, you know. That just eliminated 300 phone calls for me. Somebody saying, yeah, I think I do.
Oh, that's fascinating.
In looking over all your films, was there any that, I mean, they're all done, or is the one film called Dick, is that in post-production and hasn't been done yet?
No, Dick is in, we've actually released that independently, you know. I don't think I knew that full frontal nudity would be so daunting for distributors. That film, Dick, the director, Brian Fender, had an amazing idea that he texted to me. You know, I want to make a documentary about men talking about their dicks and how it relates to their identity. And I was like, that's amazing. He goes, yeah, and I want to shoot them all naked. And I was like, that's impossible, you know. And so he figured out a way to frame them below their heads so we would preserve their anonymity, and at the same time we'd be looking at their naked body and they'd be talking about their dicks. So he put an ad on Craigslist and solicited subjects. Lo and behold, and I thought, who really is going to answer any, you know, a posting like that? 63 subjects later, we had a film to edit. And it was literally done in his living room with a painted backdrop and his little, at that time, mini DV camera on a tripod. And we bought ourselves a little sound setup, and he just interviewed them. And so I thought this was every distributor's dream, you know? And then we find out, oh, they actually do. There's like some kind of a code about full frontal nudity, and it's, you know, it's considered obscene even if it has nothing to do with having sex or, you know, erections or whatever. And I mean, it's the human body, for God's sake. You know, who knew? So we teamed up with distributor who was willing to platform it, you know, and create a streaming specifically for the film and put together a DVD, and now we're selling it on our own website, dickdocumentary.com, through IndiePix.
So that, and is that the only one that's distributed entirely by you that way?
Yes. I've never distribution is its own business, and once you finish, you know, producing and editing and delivering a movie, you really want somebody else to take it off your hands and sell it, you know. It's so hard to continually provide enough publicity and promotion, and all those things cost money, and I think you're very fortunate if you can engage, you know, a huge professional, well-known distributor that has outlets and publicity, you know, things already in place and can give you that kind of shoulder to stand on to get your product out there. Dick is slowly gathering a bigger and bigger and bigger audience, and I mean very slowly, but, you know, it's such an important film, and I tell every man that sees it, I said, you're only going to feel better about yourself once you walk away, you know, and they do, and they all do. So it's a really interesting, you know, it's an experimental film, per se. It's just under an hour long, and it's a forum, really, of discussion about the male identity and stories about dicks, essentially. Don't tell me you're not interested in seeing it.
No, I haven't seen it, but I am interested, yeah. it's fascinating, and I didn't know where to see it, but that's really interesting, and it's interesting also how that is this kind of unknown niche because of the full frontal nudity and the difficulty of distribution and what you had to go around that was seems unlike anything else in terms of, I guess the viewing public or the censoring public or whatever you want to call it, it says something also about how we perceive nudity in the body, right?
I know.
Just that difficulty,
I mean, who
of distribution.
Knew? The body is obscene, apparently. You know, it's not meant for public consumption. I mean, it's just crazy, this country. It's actually fascinating. It makes a huge statement about our censor system, I guess.
Well, it does. I recently interviewed an artist named Joe Davis. I don't know if you know him. He's there's been films made about him, but he's an artist that kind of a scientist, genius, interstellar space artist, and he works with all kinds of things having to do with sending messages into outer space and dealing with things. And he said the Skylab and all these projects that shoot images into space or capsules with, you know, with that have time capsules of what Earth is like is in them. He said, you know how they show human beings? It's a man and a woman clothed,
and the only nudity is a Barbie doll that doesn't have any genitalia on it. Because that's what aliens will think of us. And he said even Grey's Anatomy, that was sent into space, all the reproductive organs are censored. He said,
he said,
no wonder aliens are coming in here messing with our sex organs.
They want to know if we have any.
Right. Well, how do these people reproduce? So it's kind of fascinating. I mean, and that's been going on since the 70s. But, you know, he said still something enormously conservative about NASA and the body.
The irony about a movie like Dick is when people watch it, when women watch it, they're like, I want my daughter and son to see this as soon as possible. You know, people think it's so highly educational in terms of how we stigmatize our own bodies or how we feel stigmatized by our bodies, that they want young people to see it. They think it's an educational movie, which is what Brian thought when he was making it. You know, he's like, this is so educational. It has nothing to do with obscenity, you know.
That's so great. That would be interesting to have some response from teenagers or other people who have
Yeah, there's really only one erection in the entire film, and that is even a hands-off situation. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, so in closing, of course, I want to talk about Elaine Stritch and Shoot Me. That's something that's enormously precious to you for so many reasons. I mean, especially now that she's gone and the poignant quality of so many things in that. Do you want to just say a little bit about that before I ask you questions on it? I don't want to really give it away or talk about what's happening in there, but it's I think it's such a powerful document about, you know, an acting life and how people also perceive their bodies and aging. What was your experience on that? What did you draw from that? Because I think in one way, you know, as we're at different points in our lives, there's different the way people talk about their bodies or aging. Other people experience of different ages in different ways. You know,
right.
I interviewed a dancer
right.
recently who's in his 20s and all he talks about is his aging body. And you know, people who are older than him think, "Are you crazy? Your body's not aging." Well, you know, for him it is. And
right.
But it's the perspectives that change. So, how was it like making that? And I would think it would be, if I'm not kind of forcing that on you, that there's kind of profound life changing moments in there for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure, and so many that I don't think I've even processed at all. You know, the entire experience. But, you know, I met Elaine at my hairdresser. Apparently we both had the same hairdresser. I didn't know this, but I saw her in the salon one day on 57th Street, and I thought, is that Elaine Stritch? You know, I had done like a day of work with her when I was a script supervisor on John Turturro's movie, Romance and Cigarettes. She played James Gandolfini's mother in this hilarious hospital scene with Steve Buscemi and Jim, the late, great Jim Gandolfini. And I'll never forget that day because she blows in, she plays his mom, you know, she gives him a talking to and blows off, you know. And I just remember thinking, who is this woman, you know, and John Turturro thought I was crazy because I didn't know who she was. And he goes, oh, my God, she changed my life. She did this one-woman show, Elaine Stritch at Liberty. He goes, I brought my mother to see it, and it just blew us away. You know, here she is 70-some-odd years of age doing this one-woman show about her entire career. In the theater, and it's stunning. So I remember that John, she was a somebody, and then I saw her in the salon, and my hairdresser said, you know, you should be making a documentary about her. And I thought, God, I wonder how I could do that, you know. So I sort of started courting her about it, and at the same time, I ended up a few weeks later having lunch with a friend. Who had been an executive producer on a previous project, the short film that I started off doing, and I mentioned that my hairdresser wanted me to make a film about Elaine Stritch, and I find it a fascinating idea. And she said, well, how much do you need? And literally wrote me a check for, I'd say, the first quarter of the budget. So I was very lucky to have something like that in my back pocket, especially because Elaine hadn't said yes yet, you know, and so I courted her for about 4 months, and she finally agreed to do it. And she can be such a difficult person. You never know what she's going to say. She says yes one day, she says no the next day. And we finally, you know, had a relationship that turned into a really wonderful friendship, and then she wanted us around all the time, you know, the cameraman and myself. Shane Sigler was a cameraman, Josh Weinstein was a cameraman, and Rod Lamborn, and one of them was always available when I needed them to be around, and we just spent, you know, on and off a year and a half with Elaine in her day-to-day, and then following her cabaret show from New York to Detroit to L.A., and just trying to really become intimate with this idea of what it takes to be in your late 80s and still pursuing the thing that you love, the thing that you know how to do, the thing that's made you famous, and not being able to really pull it off the way that you used to, and how does that work, you know? And it's just, you discover your story in the journey of you know, filmmaking and filming. And I didn't know, I thought we were just going to watch her just hit one out of the park every night, you know? And then I realized, oh, my God, she's having trouble with this, remembering her lyrics. She's having trouble with the diabetes. She's having trouble now that she's introduced drinking into her life again, you know? And then I thought, this is an amazing document, because my parents were 80 and 90 at the time, and my mother had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And Elaine can articulate the frustrating process of not being, having the freedom and liberty to do what you want to do anymore better than anybody. She can be funny about it and poignant about it and fierce about it and angry about it in this way that's so compelling. And she really gave me more empathy for my own parents who, you know, I see them losing the ability to do this or that or the independence. They can't drive anymore. I had to close my mother's business down. And just the fact that you just lose things. You lose the ability to just do what you've always known how to do, and how upsetting that can be, and how you adjust to what your life becomes after that. And that was this incredible journey with Elaine. And, you know, and I was going through a tremendous amount of crises in my own life. I had just broken up with somebody. I was shutting my mother's business down. She had Alzheimer's. My brother was having trouble with the law. I just had so many things in my own life that Elaine became a really good friend to me. And I think part of making the movie for both of us allowed us to focus on something other than our own problems, you know, and really kept us going. And at a certain point, she looked at me and she said, you know, I think this is good for both of us. And I knew exactly what she meant, because she knew that if I didn't have something in my life to preoccupy myself in a productive way, that I would probably fall apart, you know. And she always wanted to know, how was the footage? How was the footage? So it was kind of our baby, this film. And I was so honored to, you know, bring it to light and also preserve what I consider to be a wonderful legacy. You know, I was ashamed that I didn't know who she was after I looked back on her incredible career with Noel Coward and Tennessee Williams and on the stage and with Sondheim, and, you know, her incredible gift and talent as this singular, ballsy broad, who I'm sure she just came out of the womb as. and just preserve, there's nobody like her. There's nobody that dares to be as unique. You know, everyone's trying to be everybody else these days. They want this and that facelift, and they want the boobs, and they want the thing, and they want the hair. And she just was her own creature. And I just thought that that was an amazing, amazing and wonderful thing.
Yeah, very, very inspiring and beautiful, really. Well, thanks so much for talking with us today. This is, you know, it's really been a pleasure to hear so much about what's going on. And our listeners are also connected to the post of this, so they'll be able to, you know, look at links and perhaps all watch this film, other films, and we'll give a link to Dick so they can see that on its own platform. Is there anything you want to leave us with about Isotope Films or the future of how you're thinking about it?
I just want to keep telling stories. You know, I just want to keep telling stories that people can relate to, that inspire, that illuminate, that help us all appreciate each other and accept that we're probably more alike than we are different, no matter how we wear ourselves on the outside. And I feel like all my films are somewhat about an underdog, you know, and I just want to keep telling stories until the outside is the inside, you know. I all forms of storytelling are very similar, whether it's documentary or you know, narrative fiction. We're all trying to express ourselves. So I just hope to be able to keep doing it. So keep looking for Isotope Films.
Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I appreciate being on your show.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.